It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When you hear someone exclaim, "Great Scott," they could be referring to Scotland's favorite son, poet Robert Burns, widely regarded as the national poet of Scotland, and who is celebrated worldwide. This weekend marks the 256th anniversary of his birth, January 25th, 1759. And today, we're previewing dinners to take place in his honor and discover why the legacy of Robert Burns endures. Paul Thompson is president of the St. Andrew's Society of Pittsburgh and is with us here in studio. Later, Tim Wolfson, co-owner of Music Night on Jupiter, a grassroots local music event promotion company, will be joining our conversation. But first, Paul Thompson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Robert Burns lived from 1759 to 1796. So what should we know about him?
Well, he was the Bard of Scotland. He was probably Scotland's most famous writer. And part of that is being in the right place at the right time. At that time in Europe, there was a time of turmoil. There was the French Revolution going on. There was America approaching independence. There was all sorts of turmoil. And it was the time when titles and power were on the wane and the worth of the common man. In fact, it was the time of the rights of man was in vogue. So Burns was right in line with that. He was came from a poor background, a farming. His son, brother Gilbert worked the farm with him. But he was a brilliant writer. He was well-educated and, although poor, very intelligent. And he managed to fit in with society. He was at home in a castle as he was in a poor person's home. So he was at home at the pub drinking a beer. I think Sir Walter Scott, who knew him, said dignified humility, simplicity was the way he described his persona. So he could mix with all circles, and he wrote about many things that were really just clicked with the common man.
Well, and you mentioned the timing of his ascendancy. A lot of times for an extraordinary individual, the timing is everything. And what you're describing, this period of history in the mid to late 1700s, perhaps was not unlike that of the mid 60s, say, for example, when working class was in, where you had people like Mick Jagger lying about which part of London he grew up in because he said that he was from the poorer part because that was cool.
Right, right. It may not have been totally cool, but it was certainly becoming cool in Burns' time. He had a lot of love affairs with titled people, not always sexual, but certainly love affairs. And he was accepted. He was not quite the trained poodle to be taken round to your social event, but he was certainly paraded. And
not quite the trained poodle, meaning that he didn't have all of the manners, the prim and proper mannerisms down, but he might upend a table or two.
That is true. He certainly didn't pull any punches when he wrote.
I wanted to ask you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're talking about an extraordinary talent here, and you were talking about his education earlier. Now, this was a man who, as I understand it, he was homeschooled, but he taught himself things, and he taught himself how to write poems. What was it about him that enabled him to have this kind of insight?
I think he did teach himself, and he perfected, but he started at a very early age. He wrote his first published poem when he was 15, a love poem to Nellie Kilpatrick he was paired with in the harvest time.
Paired with? What do you mean?
Well, they used to work in pairs so that one would hold stooks of corn while the other tied the string round them, that sort
so
of
he
thing.
Was working in the fields with this
absolutely.
Woman?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
She was 13 and he was 15.
But he was attracted to her.
He wrote a love poem at that age. And I think it was natural. I think his spontaneity, I always think of him as the Mozart of poems, of poetry. You know, Mozart didn't have to construct and work on and develop music. He just wrote it. It was in his head, and his first draft was perfect. And Burns was like that. He would just write things down, and anything could set it off. One day he was in church and he saw a bug on the woman in front of him crawling up her scarf. So he wrote a poem to a louse while he was sitting there. It was anything and everything. If it set him off, he would just write a poem.
And this was the age of romanticism.
Yes.
He helped usher that in.
Yes, he was a true romantic, probably a key figure in Scotland in the Romantic Age.
And doesn't hurt that he was a dashing, you know, looking at the paintings of him, he was a handsome,
yes,
fellow. His features seemed somewhat soft, but still, you know, something that would attract people to him.
Very much. And I think that what you see is what you get. I think his poetry is like that. He was fiercely patriotic, but he wasn't in favor of war or weapons. When he became an exciseman and he eventually had to carry guns, he'd never carried weapons before. He didn't believe in killing, but yet he was fiercely patriotic. So he was a soft-natured person. I guess anybody who could turn a mouse's nest over with a plow and then stop there and watch the mouse and write a poem about it with such sensitivity, which incidentally gave us great lines like "the best laid plans of mice and men gang after thee."
That's his line.
That's his line. And he was thinking the mouse had built this nest, all prepared for winter, and then along I come and blow it all to a smithereen. So he was a softy at heart. He fell in love at the drop of a hat. You know, every other week there was a new love, and yet he stuck with Jean Armour, his wife,
with whom he had nine children.
With whom he had nine children. Only three survived, but she was very understanding too. She once said, Rab should have had twa wives, and she took them in. The bastard children she often took into her own home when they were in embarrassment to the other girl or lady. She took them in and raised them. And in the end, when he died, leaving her penniless, and she had this house full of kids and no income, they collected money in Scotland to send her, and it took a while to come in. But the first £200, which is probably like $10,000-$20,000 then, the first £200 she sent to Elizabeth Peyton, the first girl he ever got pregnant, who'd had her child in disgrace, but she sent her the first £200, just a very human environment he grew up in.
And when you talk about this idea of having a child in disgrace, I mean, these are very, very different times. If you weren't married and you had a child, it was a scandal, and today it's nothing.
Absolutely. He had to wear sackcloth and ashes to the church to even eventually recognize his marriage.
We're talking about the great Scottish poet Robert Burns, whose life and times are being celebrated this weekend, the 256th anniversary of his birth, January 25th, 1759. Talking here with Paul Thompson. He's president of the St. Andrew's Society of Pittsburgh. And we talked about the romantic aspects of Robert Burns, but he also wrote blunt political and civil commentaries. You mentioned his backing of America. He seemed to have championed the underdogs, the oppressed, and as you said, the common man.
Yes, definitely. He did write, actually. He wrote an ode to General Washington's birthday, which he praised America and praised what he referred to as Columbia's sons. So he wrote on many things. But he was far ahead of his time. And one piece that I always like This was the age of the rights of man. One of his poems he wrote, "While Europe's eye is fixed on mighty things, the fate of empires and the fall of kings, while quacks of state must each produce his..." I love that, quacks of state. "While quacks of state must each produce his plan, and even children lisp the rights of man, amid this mighty fuss, just let me mention, the rights of woman merit some attention."
That was very much ahead of its time, wasn't
very
it?
Very much ahead of its time. But Burns could see, cut through the clutter, and he wrote, as you see, didn't pull any punches.
And he was quite a source of inspiration to the founders of both liberalism and socialism.
Very much. He was a rebel and he was a socialist. One of my favorite, perhaps my favorite Burns poem is "For All That and All That." A man's a man for all that. He wrote about the common man and the worth of common man, and he often pitted that against inherited title and power, and how one was worth a lot, the other was worthless. And one of the things that I like about Burns is you don't have to understand every word of his poetry. You get the gist very easily. The Scots dialect is very descriptive, and you don't need to look up every word. You don't need to, in this case, to know what a coof is or what a birkie is. You know, a birkie is a fellow and a coof is a fool. But when Burns writes, he said in A Man's a Man, "You see yon birkie called a lord who struts and stares and all that. Though hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coof for all that. For all that and all that, his ribbon, star and all that, the man of independent mind, he looks and laughs at all that." And he was very much the worth of the common man. And I think what might have got him in trouble today is his internationalism. He viewed mankind not from a national perspective, but from an international.
It's kind of like Thomas Paine,
yes,
in that vein?
Yes, definitely. And his last verse in that sentence says, "Then let us pray that come it may, as come it will for all that, that sense and worth o'er all the earth will bear the gree," that's the prize, "will bear the gree for all that. For all that and all that, it's coming yet for all that, that man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that." So he was not, he wouldn't have put on the uniform of a national army very easily. He believed that his foe was a human being too.
He was a citizen of the world.
Yes.
We are talking with Paul Thompson about Robert Burns, celebrating his birthday this weekend. We'll come back and talk about the Robert Burns dinners that are happening. Because this man, he worked hard, but he played hard, and we're going to get into some of the partying side of Robert Burns as we celebrate the great Scottish poet today here on Essential Pittsburgh. Paul Thompson is president of the St. Andrews Society. He is with us, and also joining the conversation in this particular segment today is a gentleman who is well-versed in exactly how to celebrate the great life of Robert Burns. Tim Wolfson, who is co-owner of Music Night on Jupiter, a grassroots local music event promotion company, and he is planning a raucous celebration of Robert Burns' life tomorrow night. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks for having us here.
So this weekend, the occasion is the 256th anniversary of Burns' birth, and again, he was born on January 25th, 1759. So how is this celebrated? Paul, you're having a dinner, a Burns dinner, and Tim, you're having a Burns dinner, but there's different things going on. Paul, yours is a little more low-key?
It's probably strictly traditional. I wouldn't call it low-key. We're going to have bagpiping and singing and dancing and such like, but it's going to be very traditionally Scottish. There's certain aspects to Burns that any of the Scots will enjoy and expect. When you go to a football game, you expect to hear the national anthem sung. Mm-hmm. So it's not just there's certain traditions that we follow.
And Tim, what are you planning?
Well, our event, my event and Paul's event generally follow the same ceremony. There has been developed a ceremony that you go through for the Burns Night, and we are addressing all the same steps he is. Our music is different. If you know the Dropkick Murphys version of Amazing Grace that starts with the bagpipes and leads into the drums kicking in and then the bass, you're going to hear some of that in the songs we're doing together. We've assembled essentially a local all-star band of Celtic and other musicians, including folks from Bastard Bearded Irishman and Kalan and Devilish Mary and Red Hand Patty and Acrasia. And they're going to rock it out a little bit tomorrow night. There'll be some tender moments, but it's going to be a little bit faster than the past Burns events that I've been to.
And the celebration, I mean, it is in keeping with the spirit of Robert Burns, who was someone who worked hard as a poet, as a writer. But apparently he played as hard as he worked. Is that a fair assessment?
Definitely. Burns lived for the moment. He didn't plan ahead very often, and he didn't bother to look back. He lived in the moment.
And so this is, Tim, I mean, what you're doing tomorrow night is kind of the type of thing that Robert Burns would have enjoyed.
I think Robert Burns may have shown up at our event had he been living in Pittsburgh and been available tomorrow. It's going to be a lot of fun. And one of the things we're doing that I suspect that the other dinners around town, and there's many of them, won't be able to do is our band is going to be performing a number of songs from a collection of Burns poems called The Merry Muses of Caledonia. And I can't really recite those poetry for you today, but they are very funny, bawdy songs that reflect the type of life that Burns lived and his love for women and love for being with women.
You know, here we are, however many, you know, hundreds of years later, and we're talking about Robert Burns. There were other great writers. There were other great men that lived in that time. Why is it that Robert Burns' work has endured, Paul?
I think a lot of it is because of the Scottish diaspora that makes it worldwide. Scots took their culture with them, and Burns is by far the Bard of Scotland. I mean, way and above any of the other writers. And Scotland's had a lot of great writers, Stevenson and Barry and Sir Walter Scott and so on. But Burns is by far the spokesman of the Scottish person. And when the Scots peopled the British Empire, I mean, they were governors general of Canada, Australia, New Zealand. 9 of the first 13 colonies had Scottish governors. So we have a huge Scottish impact. And Scots took Burns with them as part of the culture. So he is recognized worldwide. He's a poet for mankind. His leanings towards the common man, he's a hero in Russia. I mean, they got him on a postage stamp. There's a Russian postage stamp with Burns on. He's on banknotes around the world. He's such an essential part of Scotland that he is everywhere. There's a lot of Scottish impact, maybe low-key, but here in Pittsburgh, you know, Pittsburgh was founded by a Scot, named by a Scot, General Forbes. Developed by a Scot, Andrew Carnegie. I think there's over 400 street and place names. And I was just in Carrick the other day, and in one of Burns' poems, the Cotter's Saturday Night, he mentions Carrick, and Tam O'Shanter mentions Carrick on Carrick's shores. I wonder if the people of Carrick know that King Robert the Bruce was the Earl of Carrick before he became king. So
it's a good question. And Tim, you're going to have all sorts of, you know, 20 and 30 somethings at your event tomorrow night. So obviously the appeal of Burns, while it is lasting, it also just continues to reverberate. There are all these young spirits gravitating to his work and to him and who want to be a part of the celebration. You're sold out tomorrow night.
Absolutely, and we've been sold out for several days now. I'm very pleased. It's our first event. It's over at Wiggle Whiskey Barrel House. If you can put Burns in context, and I'll date myself because I'm older than a lot of the attendees that'll be at my event tomorrow night, but you know, Burns was the late 1700s equivalent of a rock star. He was Bruce Springsteen. You know, he was a common man who rose to unparalleled heights and acceptance among all classes of people. And I think that still resonates. And, you know, he was that type of master with his words and his attitude and his ability to capture things that were important to everybody.
Paul, many famous Scotsmen have made their mark on the world, from Alexander Graham Bell to Andrew Carnegie, whom you mentioned. Robert Burns, though, is the man who's held in high esteem. So we've talked about his worldwide appeal, but among Scotsmen, what is it about Burns that set him apart?
I think there's an aspect of Burns that we don't often hear of. We always think of him as a lowland poet, the Bard of Ayrshire. His father was a Jacobite, a staunch Jacobite. And only 13 years before Burns was born, we had Culloden, which destroyed the Highland way of life. All the chiefs were killed. There was a tremendous retribution afterwards. And Burns' father brooked that with him when he came south to Alloway. And Burns grew up with that. So he had that, you might call it a Scottish chip on your shoulder, as he grew up. That was part of the reason he hated the Hanoverians, who were on the throne of England. But he was a bit of a rebel. So I think that had an endearing quality. Like many of the great Irish writers, he had that rebelliousness and thumbed his nose at authority. It was sort of weird that having hated authority, he eventually took a job as an exciseman with the government.
Oh, really?
So that's rather like being in West Virginia in Prohibition times and being a federal agent. but he did that. But he had it tongue in cheek. Because he rose to a supervisor. They gave him a pair of pistols to carry. He was in some gunfights. But when he eventually died, he came back from the water cure, and he called his squad the Awkward Squad, which just about summed them up. He said, whatever you do, don't let the Awkward Squad fire over me.
You can see TCM or AMC, you know, turning that into a series, the Awkward Squad.
Absolutely. Anyway, he eventually, 2 or 3 days later, they did fire over him. But what was amazing, he died in Dumfries.
And what did he die of?
Well,
he died young. He was only
37. He was 37. It was a mixture. The hard work on the farms, long hours, all weathers, had made him frail. And like many geniuses, he had a frail body. But he had a tooth extracted. And that set in eventually, link after link, became rheumatic fever he got. He went for the water cure, and that pretty much killed him. And when he came back, he just lasted a few more days and passed away in his bed. And as I said, Dumfries was a very small town. They had 35,000 people show up for his funeral.
Incredible. Incredible. Yeah. We have just a few minutes left. Do you have a favorite poem by Burns?
I do. I think it's probably A Man's a Man for All That.
Okay.
I think that encapsulates him. But there's so many. One I really like is A Fond Kiss. It's a very short poem.
That would be a good one to maybe go out on. Would you want to share that with
okay.
us? Okay. I'll let you find, while you're finding that, Tim Wolfson over here, tomorrow night you've got a lot of special things happening at your Robert Burns dinner, including a tie-in. You know, there has to be a tie-in with haggis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've hooked up with the most excellent butcher shop in Pittsburgh, Butcher on Butler from Lawrenceville, and Mike Rado has developed a special haggis recipe just for our event.
And haggis, and we'll for people who don't know, is what?
Various parts of sheep with steel-cut oats in some type of casing. We'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, it's go ahead, Paul.
It's the poor man's meat. It's all the leftovers. It's like a hot dog. All the leftover bits that you wouldn't sell or eat, the lungs, the that they call the lights in Scotland, and it's cooked mixed with oatmeal in a sheep's stomach. But Burns' famous address that
I'm
we're
hungry.
Both be using. It is. It's great. Burns' famous address was down on in the Scottish Enlightenment. He was bet a wager. Could he make an address to a haggis? And that was like, can you make a toast, like a toastmaster, right on the spot? Give us a toast to a haggis. And he did, and it was so well received. He wrote it down to a couple of days later. But it's absolutely ridiculous. It's mock heroic. Fear far your honest, sonsy face, great chieftain of the puddin' race. It's just delightful.
And you'll have somebody reciting that
absolutely
tomorrow, too.
We have an original member of the Real Mackenzies flying in from Vancouver, British Columbia, Aaron Chapman, to act as the chairman of our event, and he will be delivering the address to the haggis.
All right. Well, Paul, as we go out here, give us something liltingly lovely to move on with.
Shall I say iPhone kiss?
Yes.
This was his lover who wasn't – it was a platonic love. She was separated. Nancy McElhoes, her husband had gone to the West Indies, and she was eventually going to follow him. And when she left, she broke Burns' heart. And this Sir Walter Scott said – encapsulated love stories, a thousand love stories in a few lines. Aphon kiss and then we sever. A farewell, alas, forever. Deep in heart-wrung tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee. Who shall say that fortune grieves him? With the star of hope she leaves him. Me, nay cheerful twinkle lights me, dark despair around benights me. I'll ne'er blame my partial fancy. Nothing could resist my Nancy. But to see her was to love her, love for but her and love forever. Had we never loved so kindly, had we never loved so blindly, never met or never parted, we had ne'er been broken-hearted. Fare thee weel, thou first and fairest, fare thee weel, thou best and dearest. Thy'd be ilka joy and treasure, peace, enjoyment, love and pleasure. A fond kiss, and then we sever. A farewell, alas, forever. Deep in heart-wrung tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage thee.
And that's Paul Thompson, president of the St. Andrew Society of Pittsburgh, reading one of the works of the great Scottish poet Robert Burns, whose birthday we're celebrating this weekend. It's being celebrated in Pittsburgh, and Paul Thompson's having his Robert Burns dinner event, and Tim Wolfson, who's also been with us, co-owner of Music Night on Jupiter, a grassroots local music event promotion company, and they're having the raucous celebration tomorrow. And I want to thank both of you for joining us to celebrate and remember and appreciate the work of the great Robert Burns. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, pop culture contributor Joe Woes on the history of film censorship and its connection to the Steel City. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.